Moving right along through the Lankavatara Sutra, covering the essential teachings of the Buddha in the sutra, the key principles of Yogacara, the yogic practice tradition, the mind-only tradition. We've talked about the three natures, the three modes of reality. And now we come to the five dharmas. Five phenomena, in this case, dharmas. Five things. And this is basically just a reworking of the three natures, and it's unique to this sutra. I don't think that this is taught in any other Yogacara teachings. So this is a Lankavatara teaching, and it's brought up again and again in the Buddha's lists of what bodhisattvas should understand. The three natures, the two kinds of selflessness, the five dharmas, and the eight consciousnesses. So, this is on the handout on page 2. It's page 245. It's LXXXIII section. Ah, very good. Five dharmas, which are called appearance, name, projection, suchness, and correct knowledge. And the Buddha will link these together with the three natures in here. But first he just defines them. We've already heard these terms, but here's some more definitions of them. Mahamati, as for appearance, nimitta, sometimes translated as the signs of objects, the nimitta. As for appearances, what appears to visual consciousness, we name form. So already, right in the first sentence, there's another one of the second of the five dharmas is called name, or nama. So, as for appearances, what appears to visual consciousness, we name form. What appears to auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, or conceptual consciousness, we name, in quotes, sound, smell, taste, feeling, or thought. These are the names for appearances. So, we could say it's the way objects are revealed to us are the appearances, right? It's sensory objects of color, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mental objects. The way we know them is through their signs or appearances, and then we have names for those appearances. And as we spoke of in earlier classes, it's when the name, you know, the name brown gets fused together with the appearance of brown, the visual appearance of brown, and the name gets linked to the appearance, then we like grasp it as something that actually exists apart from mind. And I think that I proposed in an earlier class that the names themselves, you know, brown, tan, wall, zendo, person, are just percolating up from the storehouse consciousness. They're just sounds made with different tongue positions, and they're just dependently arisen appearances, you know. They're just, that's all they are. And then the appearances themselves, the colors and sounds and so on, are also just other dependent arisings. So if we categorize them as one of the three natures, I've proposed that names are just other dependent phenomena, and appearances are other dependent phenomena, but there's a special thing when they get like linked together, when we think that the appearance is the name. In other words, we think this really is brown. That when they get stuck together like that, that's when we have the so-called imaginary nature. We could also call that grasping the signs, or grasping the appearances, grasping the names. When they're grasped, they're also, we could call that the imaginary or imputational nature. I think we could talk about any of those three ways: grasping appearances, grasping names, or just appearances getting linked with names. Appearances being believed to be the names, or names and appearances fused together as one actual entity, which is also grasped as real or grasped as external. That's when we have the imaginary. So names and appearances, I propose, are classified as other dependent phenomena, but they're the building blocks, the essential building blocks for the imaginary nature. Does that make sense? The sutra doesn't say it quite like this, but this is one way to make sense of it. So that's a definition of appearances, and names is in there too. Mahamati projection, or sankalpa, related to, remember, the imaginary nation is called, imaginary nature is called parikalpita, the completely imagined. Kalpita is like the past participle of the object of imagination, the imagined, but sankalpa is just kind of imagining or projecting or discriminating. So that's an important distinction in the Sanskrit. This project, and Red Pine uses a completely different word here. He uses projection instead of imagination. But I think we could translate it either way. Again, as opposed to the projected or the imagined, which would be like the actual fixed, believed, real thing. And that's when full-fledged delusion has set in and the origins of grasping and discontent. But just the projections themselves are just, again, I would say, this third of the five natures here, called projection, is also just a other dependent phenomena. But again, it's a building block. It's an essential piece of the puzzle to construct the imaginary nature. So projection fabricates names and points to appearances. So it ties it together there. It's using all three of these five dharmas here. The projection fabricates the names, it makes up the names, and it points to the appearances as being, quote, like this and not something else, unquote.
It distinguishes.
Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki translates it as discrimination instead of projection. What we name, an elephant or a horse, a charioteer or a foot soldier, a man or a woman, this is what's meant by projection. So you could even say this fusing together of the name and the appearance is that process of linking them together. We could also say is the process of projection. And when they're fused together, now it's the imaginary nature or the projected nature. But the process of projection, that's using names and appearances to create a world, an apparent world, that process is just an other dependently arising process. Mahamati, according to correct knowledge, samyajnana. So, you know, in the Eightfold Path, we talk about right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. That right is samyak. So right or correct knowledge. Jnana, in this case, is that same jna is the root of prajna. In this case, jnana means like non-dual, true, correct knowledge. In general, jnana means this. It means non-discriminating, non-conceptual, and non-dual gnosis or wisdom. Gnosis, yeah. As opposed to, if you divide it into dualistic knowledge, that the kind of knowledge or consciousness that knows, that's like me knowing something, that's called vijnana, right? So it's the same jnana, the non-dual, direct knowing. If you divide it with a vi, in Sanskrit the vi is like the same as the English divide. It's like the, it's like a divided or bifurcated jnana. And that's what we call vijnana, is the word we use to translate the consciousness, like the consciousness skanda. So this is before it's divided, direct, non-dual gnosis, like Buddha, wisdom. This is correct knowledge. According to correct knowledge, names and appearances are indistinguishable, like passerby. So D.T. Suzuki translates this, instead of indistinguishable, he says ungraspable or unobtainable. And instead of like passerby, he says due to mutual conditioning. So I think this is difference in Sanskrit and Chinese and so on. But that's a place where I appreciate D.T. Suzuki's. Names and appearances are unobtainable or ungraspable due to being mutually conditioned. In other words, they're just, because they're dependently arising, you can't get a hold of them as fixed entities. And indistinguishable, I don't know if it accords with the original languages here, but I would like to propose saying that names and appearances are not confused to be the same. And in that way, it's almost saying like they are distinguishable. But not exactly. Remember, this is according to this non-dual, non-distinguishing knowledge. But according to correct knowledge, names and appearances are not confused. Or as I was saying, when names and appearances get fused and confused together to be the same thing, that's when the problem comes. But according to correct knowledge, names can be arising, like blah, 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 flowers, altars, ceilings. That's and then there can be appearances of what we call flowers, altars, ceilings. And if they're not confused to be the same, like that really is a flower, that really is an altar, correct knowledge doesn't confuse them to be the same. Can you follow that? According to correct knowledge, names and appearances are not fused together into what creates a seemingly real entity or seemingly external entity. Yes.
Before a child acquires language, because children have preferences, they have images, but they don't have names for them.
Yeah. They seem to be making distinctions before they learn verbal language.
Could it be instead of name, label, or?
Yeah, I think we can do the same process before we have the actual speech functions or writing functions. I think that babies and also animals that never learn language can still do this, this process in this kind of pre-linguistic way, almost like they have the setup for distinguishing that language is such a wonderful tool for making these distinctions. Once we learn it, it's like, let's use that. This, not that. It's so easy to just immediately, with very little effort, with our language, just split up the world into infinite different things. But I think that babies and non-speaking animals have the same mind mechanisms, almost like a pre-linguistic way of still distinguishing through maybe symbols would be another way to look at it. The Sandinamochana Sutra talks about. I think it when it talks about names, it often mentions symbols along with that. So that could be like, or in our own experience where we have language, when we see something and we don't quite have the name for it yet, we're still distinguishing it as something different from something else. And sometimes we see symbols would be like almost like a shape of something that goes in a certain category. It's like categorizing. And I think animals can categorize things without language, right? This is food and this is like rock. They're making these distinctions, right? Even very simple animals can do these without words, but it's like this thing, and they're doing it with appearances, right? This appears to be like the last thing that I ate that tasted good without that whole sentence. And that I once tried eating a rock like that and it didn't work.
Does preference and desire enter into it?
That you could say preference and desire is based on making these basic distinctions. First we're making the distinctions, this is food and this is a rock, and then almost immediately afterwards, what I would say afterwards, is the like, and we like to eat the apple and not the rock. Yeah, all these things, right, are like, Yogacara gives this whole process kind of a bad rap, right, of like, we're making these distinctions and it's causing suffering and difficulties for us, but we do need it, yeah, I think, of course, we need it. Evolution has created distinguishing traits very well. We're the ones who survived. The distinguishers have made it this far along in the evolutionary stream. Very nice. Here we are. And now we can start to actually, by making distinctions through word, the sutra is all words and language, talking about appearances and so on. Through this very process of making distinctions, we can start to unravel what we're doing. And then again, it might be not so much that we stop making the distinctions, it's just that we see the process. We don't have to stop choosing the apple instead of the rock. That would be like not a good use of Buddhist studies. But more like, oh, I see that this whole thing is kind of like, is mind created. Therefore, still, there's practical, in the conventional world, we still eat the apple. But the whole thing is a little bit more flexible. Yeah, that's one way to look at it. When we see that the process, we're going to eat the apple instead of the rock, and maybe it's even, talk about it, like, I actually like apples more than bananas. We can make that distinction, okay, so eat the apple. But then somebody says, we're out of apples today, but would you like a banana? And it's still healthy, it's going to nourish us, we can say, that's okay. I can see that preferential thing for the apple, there's a little more flexibility around it instead of like, apples are better than bananas. All the, you know, the infinite distinctions and preferences we start to make based on these basic divisions. The whole thing gets loosened up more. And then And maybe once in a while, we might even try a rock. Just to, you know, check, see if it has some iron or something.
When I read this, what I understood by it, how I made sense of it anyway, is that there is a point in being aware where there is not yet a name assigned. This translation confused me a little bit on that. It gave me a struggle because it says names and appearance are indistinguishable.
Mm.
But
yeah.
I think there's a point of awareness where there is no name and you can't even say what is appearing as
appearance. Yeah. I think indistinguishable is a bit of a problem there too.
Because by saying names and this are indistinguishable, you're distinguishing them. But I think in practice there is a level of being present and awareness that one can be aware of that which is arising before it is distinguished, before it is put into a useful category.
There can be awareness of appearances before it's put into a category. Maybe so, yeah. There's just the immediate appearance.
Just the immediate, and that would be correct knowledge. And then we defile the correct knowledge by making it useful or particular or specific in some way.
But the only thing there is, I would say, my understanding of correct knowledge here, correct jnana, is that it's not even, strictly speaking, aware of appearances, even. Because appearances themselves are like these other dependent mirage-like. Remember, appearances are like kind of like mirages. And there is value in just seeing the mirage as the mirage. But then in correct knowledge, it seems to imply that it's not even seeing the mirage, as we go on with the sentence here, when the different forms of consciousness do not arise, and they are neither annihilated nor eternal. So it's almost like contradicting that, because it's saying do not arise, but we're not saying that that's annihilation. We're saying that ultimately, truly, nothing arises and ceases. But we're not talking about annihilationism or eternalism. This is a middle way of emptiness here. But this is a hard sentence. When the different forms of consciousness do not arise, and they are neither annihilated nor eternal, and one does not end up in the realms of Shravakas, Prateka Buddhas, or other paths, this is what's meant by correct knowledge. So the point about Shravakas and Prateka Buddhas, people have heard about, this is the pre or non-Mahayana, non-Bodhisattvas. And I think, you know, philosophically speaking, it would be like a maybe more nihilistic view of, this would be one way to look at it, a kind of, there's no self here at all, and so let's just forget about everything. or there's no self of the person, right? This is one of the two selflessnesses, but all these, you know, there's no real me, but the five skandhas that kind of make up me, they really exist, and the zendo and the flowers and all this really exists. That's what that would be like, a traditional take on what Shravakas and Prateka Buddhas, their understanding is that the self of the person really doesn't exist, so they're liberated to a certain extent by that, quite a strong extent, but the world and of external phenomena really does exist to Shravakas and Prateka Buddhas. So it's just making this point that when one doesn't end up in this realm of just seeing through the personal self, but not yet seeing through the selves of all phenomena, that don't really truly exist in the way that they appear, not stopping with just the person. This is what's meant by correct knowledge. Buddha knowledge sees the emptiness of the self, of the person, and the emptiness of the so-called self of all phenomena. Moreover, Mahamati, as a result of correct knowledge, bodhisattvas neither assert names nor appearances, nor do they not assert names or appearances. So just when we think that, like, okay, the bodhisattvas are just steering clear, like, we're not going to name anything, we're not going to get into appearances, we're cool. But actually, they don't fall into this one-sided thing of, like, we're cool, don't mess with us. It's kind of like, oh, we can say ba ba wa wa, or or flower, he he, or whatever. They can say such things, and they can assert appearances, like, did you see that wild goose fly by? They're allowed to do that, bodhisattvas, because they don't really believe that the name is linked to the appearance. I think this is the world of Zen expression too, where it's like all these words can be used in these new, fresh ways without sticking to words. So there's a kind of a beautifully Zen-like expression, actually, that bodhisattvas neither assert names nor appearances, nor do they not assert names or appearances. They avoid dualistic views of assertion or denial because they know that names and appearances do not arise. Or we could say, do not truly arise. Because from the point of view of, remember, the other dependent nature, it is the appearance of names and appearances are arising according to the other dependent nature. But from the point of view of the perfect nature, nothing arises, right? In other words, the other dependent nature, which means other dependent arising, doesn't truly exist from the point of view of the perfect nature.
So would it be okay for me to think that what's being said here is that bodhisattvas practice simply being present and appropriate?
Bodhisattvas practice being present and appropriate, and they're also free from being present and appropriate.
Well,
they're not stuck in being present and appropriate.
I wouldn't go that far. It's a nice device, but I wouldn't go that far. I think being present and appropriate is to be simply with the dynamism of impermanence, and do so in a way that is compassionate and helpful and all that kind of business. But not being invested in outcomes, not being invested in causes and conditions.
But you don't want to discriminate that as being more right than not being present and appropriate, right?
I think if one is not being present and appropriate, one is not behaving in the function of bodhisattva.
But bodhisattva is free of all that.
They're free of that distinction. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to go that far, but eventually you might.
We think bodhisattva battles in order to be bodhisattva. You know, bodhisattva is not some idealized thing that we can achieve. We have to take vows to practice being bodhisattvas.
But those vows, a vow to save all beings, we have to not get stuck in a fixed idea of saving all beings, and, like, you know, and that means, like, I'm definitely not going to not save all beings.
Well, I mean, of course, but to save all beings, one has to be perfectly present to one's self and what's going in front of one. If I am not attending to practice and not being compassionate to who's in front of me, I am making an exception to the word all. There's no way around that. Being fully present, one necessarily fulfills the view of all.
Yeah, just that you're saying this so strongly that I would be careful about discriminating that as like the definitive way. I think that's what this sentence is saying, right? Because it's like they don't assert names and appearances. That sounds so great, right? Like, why do we need to say more? But then, nor do they not assert names and appearances. Like, they're free to not get caught in any sides about anything. That's all. So I think if we're talking about things, I agree, but then if we say really strongly, like, it really is this way, and if I say, well, what about what, the other side? You say, no, forget the other side, it's this way.
No, but I think in the moment of actually being fully present, there isn't any distinguishing.
Yeah, but these are all words, too. We just get...
Well, that's why I like to bring it to practice.
Yeah. So, are you fully present?
And yes.
So, are you okay with me saying basically anything?
Yes.
Oh.
Are you okay with me saying anything?
Okay. Next! Yes.
I don't quite understand that simile using like passerby. What is
that? I don't know. Yeah, that's a funny one.
Okay,
so D.T. Suzuki says names and appearances are unobtainable due to mutual conditioning. So, instead of like passerby.
Yeah, passersby.
Somebody, if you're in a big crowd in New York City and there's a flood of people walking by you, you're not distinguishing each one. There's Joe.
Okay, yeah. That seems to be the sense of it, yeah. The Buddha told Mahama, they avoid dualistic views of assertion and denial because they know the names and appearances do not, truly arise. Because they do appear to arise, but they don't truly arise. This is what's meant by suchness. Ta ta ta. That's the fifth of the five dharmas. Is free of all dualistic views of assertion and denial. You know, the song of the trusting mind is so much about this, right? What's the line about if you assert emptiness, you get stuck in emptiness? You turn away from emptiness to deny appearances.
To deny the existence of things is to get stuck in existence.
To deny the existence of things is to get stuck in existence. To assert emptiness is to turn away from emptiness. The more you talk and think about it, the further astray you wander from the truth. So that's this like part where we're getting into suchness and correct knowledge is in that realm where the words and the meanings are breaking down. The Buddha told Mahamati, the three modes of reality as well as the eight forms of consciousness and the two kinds of no-self, which is the no-self of persons and things, are all included in the five dharmas. Obviously let's keep going. Mahamati, name and appearance are the imagined mode of reality. Now this is, if we take it just as it says it there, that's maybe different than what I was proposing, that the names and appearances as they're just arising are just part of the other dependent nature. But when they're grasped or when they're fused together, they become the imagined. So again, this is, the sutra seems to contradict itself at various places. And but this would be my understanding of what's going on here. So I would add in parentheses, Mahamati, name and appearance, when fused together, or when grasped, or when reified, are the imagined mode of reality. I would say it like that. Mahamati, because the mind and what belongs to the mind are dependent on projection for their existence and arise together with name, just as do the sun and its rays. Sun and its rays is like the mind and its thoughts, the source of thoughts and then the thoughts that emanate from it. And because they are supported by the differentiation of their various appearances, they constitute the dependent mode. So this is, the Buddha is linking the five dharmas with the three modes of reality, or three natures now, right? So he just says name and appearance are the imagined mode. I would say name and appearance, when they're grasped, if you go back to the previous sections, the Buddha does say it more like that, when they're grasped. Those make up the imagined mode of reality. The mind and what depends on the mind, or mind and what belongs to the mind, dependent on projection. All these things that the mind is projecting, the projections supported by the differentiation of their various appearances constitute the dependent mode. So names and appearances, when grasped, constitute the imagined mode of reality. Projections is a complicated way of basically saying projections, and all that how that works with the mind, and with the mind is the mind's objects and so on, are the dependent mode before they're grasped as the imagined. There's just projecting creating these mirage-like dependent appearances. And Mahamati, because correct knowledge and suchness are indestructible, they make up the perfected mode. So appearance, name, and projection together are like creating, we could say, both the other dependent and the imagined mode, and then suchness and correct knowledge are this other category that's the perfect or thoroughly established nature or mode of reality.
Correct knowledge and suchness really different?
Maybe not really. But one way we could say, I would think of it, is that suchness is almost like the object of observation for correct knowledge. So one's more like the subject. Even though this is a realm where there's no subject and object, still that correct knowledge observes suchness, and suchness is what's observed by correct knowledge, right?
And they co-arise,
and they're actually completely non-dual. Yeah. I guess strictly speaking, we wouldn't even say they co-arise, because they don't arise and cease.
They co-function.
Yeah. They co-function, and this is a nice point, because the thoroughly established is not just emptiness or suchness, which is more like a ontological status of things. It also includes wisdom, Buddha mind. So does that make sense? And this is the link to the next section now, that the thoroughly established nature, perfect nature of things, is both the emptiness of all fixed phenomena, or also called suchness, indivisible, non-arising, non-ceasing, ungraspability. And it also includes the Buddha mind. See how that's different now? The mind that's actually aware of emptiness, the mind that realizes suchness, is different than suchness. Now, we could say the mind that realizes suchness is also suchness, but there's this Buddha awareness, Buddha mind. And this is also the link now to Buddha nature, which is this next section.
So the co-functioning of suchness and correct knowledge, mm-hmm, is actually the pivot, the linchpin for Yogacara, mind only.
the linchpin, or you could say the goal, or the final realization. I don't know, there may be many linchpins.
The principle that suchness and correct knowledge
have
this intimate, indispensable co-function.
Yeah, or you could say the truth of Yogacara and stuff. But Yogacara also has all these teachings about how delusion works. So maybe various linchpins. Like you could say that another linchpin in the story of the three natures is the other dependent nature is this like central linchpin around, and when these other dependent mirage-like appearances are grasped as truly existing or truly external, then they become this fixated delusion. But when the mirage is just seen as mirage, and it's not grasped, then it becomes, or its true nature is actually the perfect nature. So that's another maybe a linchpin, this central thing that can either be grasped or released, and it's all it, and it's just the other dependent appearances of this right now. Here we are. We're gonna grasp it, or we're gonna see through it. Yes.
Suchness always is.
Suchness always is.
Correct knowledge is the goal of our understanding. But the suchness does not change through our absence.
This is a nice point that suchness always is. It's called the perfect nature. That can also be translated as the thoroughly established nature. I mean, it's thoroughly established, and it's actually permanent. It's not a thing, but this non-thing doesn't come and go. The way that nothing can be grasped is always the case. Nothing can ever be grasped. Nothing ever was able to be grasped. It doesn't come and go. And this is interesting, because you could say that on first reflection it seems that, well, it doesn't come and go, but then this Buddha wisdom can arise and then realize this something that doesn't come and go. But it's not always the case, right? You might ask. And this is the neat thing about, I would start to equate here now this samyak jnana, this correct knowledge. I would equate that with Buddha nature, or Tathagata Garbha, and actually the amazing thing here is that doesn't come and go either. You could say the complete openness to it, its full functioning, you could say that could come and go. It's fully functioning through some beings and not others, but the beauty of it is that it's not something that like has to be produced that's already not here, or that's not already here. It's that this correct knowledge is, if we're saying that that's Buddha nature, that it is actually functioning through all of us right now. That's the amazing thing. But you can say, but why do we still see that this is separate from me? It's just because of the obscurations that block it. But that's the one of the most joyful and amazing and freeing teachings about Buddha nature is that, and it's like the good news is like, us little deluded beings, if we have to like become Buddhas, it just seems so like depressing and like endless and like how, and impossible. Our like whole world is built on like separation and dualistic thinking. But if we can trust that actually there's this non-dual radiant awareness all the time, it's our birthright, we're born with it along with all the dualistic obscurations that we're born with, that they're riding side by side, or you know, the relationship there is something we can start to talk about. It gets tricky to talk about. But that our true, we are actually non-dual with everything and just coursing in suchness with perfect Buddha wisdom right now. And at the same time, there's like this like veil over that whole reality. Yes?
I was reading back in it, it says that that's our primordial nature. Who says that in here?
Tathagatagarbha?
Yeah, Tathagatagarbha is the primordial nature.
Yeah.
And that veil, I was just talking about that, that veil is, how does that, do we produce that?
Who's we, right?
That's what I'm saying, what is it?
Yeah. Well, in a way, you could say that's what a lot of these, what we've been talking about, this model of the three natures and so on, is a story of how the veil gets produced. You could call the veil is basically the way the other dependent nature and the imagined nature work together to create the illusion of separation or externality or fixed reality. So it's like, you could say, who creates the veil? It's basically the this process, and remember we have the story of the storehouse consciousness. That'll be another, you could say again, kind of like an ontological model of how the veil gets created is the three natures. It's like the how things exist. It's like looking at things from the nature of existence and a kind of impersonal process, you could say, is the three natures. But you could say another a kind of more psychological process, or epistemological process maybe, would be like the eight consciousnesses, and include so how the storehouse consciousness is basically has all these karmic seeds from all this past dualistic activity that just keeps reinforcing itself. So remember that story of like from last week, I think, of like a seed sprouts from the storehouse consciousness, and the seed has these two like stems, right? Two little like branches, and one of them is like an eye organ, for example, and a color. So one non-dualistic seed arises with the appearance of like a subject and an object, and then maybe we have another seed along with that that says, that's really the way it is. I see you over there, and you're not my mind. And so we have all these, you know, that's the veil, right? Is I believe that you're over there and not completely non-separate from this mind. But that veil is created by all these karmic dispositions for the veil. And again, from the evolutionary, kind of scientific evolutionary point of view, I think we could maybe say that that's just like, again, like Darwinian evolution, we could say also is what created the veil, because the beings that could distinguish the rock and the apple are the ones that survived. So the genes for separation and distinguishing are the ones that survived. And from a kind of, from the mind psychological point of view, you could say that's the evolution of the storehouse consciousness becomes more and more permeated by dualistic appearances and the belief that that's how things really are. But the storehouse consciousness actually in its true nature, right, this is again a tricky thing that we're going to have to talk about here, that alaya vijnana is like the same as, or its true nature is, the Tathagatagarbha. And I think we're going to go to this right now. I think we're going to skip this last paragraph on the five dharmas. You can read on your own. It's I tried to collect all the sections on this, so let's skip it because this class and the next class are the last ones, and this is this big new topic now on the last two pages here. Tathagatagarbha.
So what
page in the book? Page 109.
Sorry?
109. XXVIII. Section 28. This is where we're taking a turn now, but I think it's, we've, you know, we're built on this whole system of the eight consciousnesses, if you can remember from a few months ago. And then there's three modes of reality, three natures, five dharmas. All this is helping us to, it's a structural setup. For now, we can talk about Tathagata Garbha, which is sometimes linked with Yogacara. Sometimes it's like its own school, like the Tathagata Garbha teachings. Because other sutras, Tathagata Garbha, which actually means, Tathagata means the thus come one, which is an epithet, a name for the Buddha, the thus come one. And Garbha means, it can mean like womb or embryo, but it can also mean like heart or pith or core of something. And in the various commentaries on this, it seems that that's closer to the meaning. Some people would propose it's like the womb that gives rise to a Buddha. It's like the potential for a Buddha. And that is one way to look at it. But I think more accurately and more in accord with non-duality, I think it's nice to say the heart of the Tathagata, that what really makes a Buddha, is Tathagata Garbha, or also we could call it Buddha nature. Again, it's kind of like the suchness fused with Buddha wisdom. So suchness, yeah, fused with Buddha wisdom.
Like suchness of consciousness, maybe.
Yeah, we could suchness of consciousness. We could, I think we could say that too. Yeah, the true nature of consciousness, of even of dualistic consciousness, is that it's perfect wisdom. It's not dual, it's non-dual wisdom. And non-dual Buddha wisdom is another name for Buddha nature. Now there's another thing, there's this issue too of like, is there a difference between Buddha nature and Buddha nature and Tathagata Garbha from now on? We can equate these terms in the tradition, they're basically equated. Is there a difference between that and like a fully realized Buddha? And in a way, no. The content of their mind is the same Buddha nature. It doesn't improve in the slightest in a Buddha over a sentient being. But there's a difference between a sentient being with Buddha nature and a fully realized Buddha. The difference being is that the sentient being with Buddha nature has all these obscurations that are like the veil that's blocking the full shining of the Buddha nature. And for a Buddha, all the obscurations have dropped away. And again, the dropping away, I just have to bring up again the snake and the rope metaphor, because I think it's so appropriate for this kind of thing, is that it's not like we have to like peel back the obscurations like one at a time, or chisel them away, or rip them off. It's more like, you don't rip the snake out of the garden hose, right? It's like you just look really closely at the garden hose. I mean, at what you think is the snake, which is called obscurations, illusory obscurations, and you see that it's not actually a snake. So again, removing the obscurations, the Buddha nature, is just looking closely at them and seeing that they're actually not obscurations. Does that make sense?
Isn't the Alaya Vishnana rightly perceived?
That would be one way to look at this. Now we're going to see the Buddha in this sutra, and this is the only sutra that basically equates Buddha nature, Tathagata Garbha, with Alaya Vijnana. So it does this whole, it equates that. Whereas some other, teachings previous to this maybe would say that Alaya Vijnana is basically the storehouse of delusion. It's all these karmic tendencies. And remember, because we have these teachings like transformation of the basis. The basis is Alaya Vijnana, and it's transformed or revealed to be perfect wisdom in the end. And it actually ceases. I mean, it's sometimes talked about, even Vasubandhu says like, in like an arhat and a Buddha, Alaya Vijnana doesn't exist anymore. Whereas this is saying alaya vijnana. That might not be contradictory, but here it's saying alaya vijnana is Buddha nature, or it doesn't say it explicitly, but a way to understand that might be that alaya vijnana in its true nature is Buddha nature. Or let me just like mention a couple other like just ways to look at this relationship, and then we'll see what the sutra says. But one is that the so the true nature of the delusions in the storehouse consciousness is Buddha nature, which is a little bit like saying the true nature of other dependent appearances is suchness. It's like that when you look at the mirage, it's true, perfect. It has this perfect nature that of suchness, where it's actually not a mirage. At the very same time as it appears as a mirage, so that kind of relationship. Also, we could see it like that. It's like almost like first there's this Buddha nature, and that gives rise to appearances that we call alaya vijnana. It's like there's perfectly clear Buddha nature, and that somehow, and we might want to talk about why or how this would happen, but that perfect non-dual Buddha wisdom actually like starts to produce mirages, basically. Mm-hmm. And the mirages are called alaya vijnana, in this case, we could say. It's this huge collection of mirage qualities. And so another image that I haven't read, but this is the one that I'm working with these days around this sutra's equating alaya with Tathagatagarbha, is that Tathagatagarbha Buddha nature is like a pool of water. It's perfectly clear, there's no obscurations, there's no distinctions, perfectly pure water. And then within that water, we could almost say in some chemical process, the water itself is producing little bits of sediment. And that sediment, these particles in the water, like infused, spread out throughout the water, these particles are, we could even call them like the seeds of alaya vijnana. See how that metaphor works? It's like, so therefore, you can say they're one thing. It's a pool of water, but it's completely murky with these particles of dualistic obscurations implanted through karmic conditioning through eons of time. And then you could say the process of practice is settling out all the particles in the clear water. That you could say settling out, we're settling out alaya, vijnana, is settling down to the bottom of the pool. And we could call that transformation of the basis. It's like actually gone now. And now there's just a clear pool.
Right. So Nirmanakaya, and we refer to Shakyamuni Buddha as our example, mm-hmm. is a special case of Dhammakaya. And as it is, in that the money pool is a special case of pure water. So as we are transforming the body through our practice, say, what we are actually doing then is invoking the hiddenness of the Dharmakaya, which is then the Tathagatagarbha. So long as we have the Manakaya, transformation body, the Dharmakaya is the Tathagatagarbha. When it is all purified, it is the Dharmakaya.
That's actually the way that it's said more, the tradition says more, that it's not so much that we have the Dharmakaya right now. It's that, just like you just said, when Tathagatagarbha is completely purified, all the sediments down at the bottom, and now it's Buddha nature free of all obscurations, that's what we call Dharmakaya. So Dharmakaya is like fruitional.
So we can conceptually reverse that and say the Dharmakaya chooses to become Nirmanakaya for the benefit of all beings. In other words, a special case makes these teachings in a kind of bodhisattva way and then goes off again. But the Buddha in being the Buddha, being the Manakaya Buddha, is not really attached in the same way we're attached karmically to all these appearances. It's a special case of the Dharmakaya saying, I'm showing up as appearances for your benefit so that you can begin transforming and becoming Dharmakaya.
That's an interesting story, and I hesitate to get too into Nirmanakaya, and especially Nirmanakaya at this point, but it is true that the usual story is that in a way, first there's the Dharmakaya, there's the realization of Dharmakaya is the Buddha body free from all obscurations, and it's beyond all physical forms or anything. And then that's the traditional story, is that the Dharmakaya in a way like emanates a Nirmanakaya, which is a transformation body, like Shakyamuni Buddha, that can appear to humans. But the tricky thing is, it's a whole other discussion, right? Because the Nirmanakaya is like a Buddha body, it's a transformation body, so it's like, we're not like, I mean, you said that, but we're not like Nirmanakayas. Like, a sentient being is not like it's not like the Dharmakaya comes back into a sentient being. Like, we don't say a Nirmanakaya is a sentient being.
No.
So it's a whole other kind of like piece of the puzzle is in the sutra, but I hesitate to get too into it now. But I think it's good to mention that Buddha nature, when it's completely free from all the obscurations, another synonym of obscurations, it's kind of funny to say, but is sentient being. So when the Buddha nature is actually dropped off a sentient being, which is the sediment, it's called sentient being, which is our karmic self, you know, then that's dropped off, then there's just Buddha nature, free from the obscurations, is now called Dharmakaya, or the Dharma body of the Buddha. And then that can, in this completely, I mean, according to the story, a completely inconceivable, beyond any, like, little stories we can tell about it, the way that manifests, Nirmanakaya, can happen, according to tradition. But the way that happens is like, we're not going to be able to get at that from our sentient being mind, even according to the tradition.
But we can practice softening our imputations.
We can do that.
That's a form of transformation.
Yeah, that's where we're going. This whole process, you could say that's the basic practice. Yeah. That's and you could say our vows, again, this is like, you know, in modern times we maybe don't think this way, and even Zen can go beyond all these traditional stories, but the traditional Mahayana story is like, we vow to actually do this work and actually become a Dharmakaya and manifest a Nirmanakaya and manifest a Sambhogakaya, bliss body, pure land, creator, inconceivable, rainbow thing. So, yeah, we vow. Eventually. No hurry. But the reason, the great thing, the reason that we can, it sounds so absurd in this story, is like, yeah, we're going to do that, but I think the great thing that makes it actually possible is that it's like, we don't have to create that stuff. We don't like have to build a Dharmakaya and a Nirmanakaya. It's all our work is just like looking more closely at the rope and fixating less and less on what we think is going on. Okay. So Mahamati Bodhisattva then asked the Buddha, in the sutras, this is kind of funny here, right? She says, in the sutras, the Bhagavan, you, the Buddha, say that the Tathagatagarbha is like in other sutras. And historically speaking, there were other sutras teaching Tathagatagarbha before the Lankavatara. specifically the Srimala Devi Sutra, which is later mentioned in here. It's like, you taught in the Srimala Devi Sutra, which is kind of unusual. So that one, that's one of our women ancestors, Srimala Devi. Mm-hmm. It's a Buddha Nature Sutra, short one that you can read. Also, there's the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, is probably the earliest one to appear. And the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, not the one in the Pali Canon, but the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra, are all teaching Buddha Nature and Tathagatagarbha. It probably historically appeared in the world before this Lankavatara. So this is kind of a building on all these other ones. In the sutras, the Bhagavan says that Tathagatagarbha is intrinsically pure, endowed with the 32 attributes, which is these 32 marks of a Buddha. So basically we can see it as just like all Buddha qualities. And again, imagine this is now that we... It's hard to what the verb is here. We have this, or us sentient beings. Not exactly like we have it, but it's like we are it. You know, it's our true nature. So our true nature is actually 32 attributes of the Buddha, but they're obscured, so we can't use them. Like we have these long earlobes, but they don't look that way. Yes.
I may be way off of this, so don't feel obligated.
Yeah, well, how do you define energy?
Well, I think, I guess I'm thinking of it as synonymous with the same sort of list here about Tathagatagarbha. You know, it's nirvana, emptiness, it's just kind of
that. I like energy. I mean, this is just my limited understanding of what energy means. I think it's a pretty good word, actually. Yeah, but I would say, like, it's energy beyond energy. Or energy free from all our ideas of what energy is.
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of that which you could in theory get to if you were able to universally deconstruct down to the very point at which there was nothing.
But I do like the word energy in the sense that it's not personal, right?
Yeah.
It's not like our true nature is like this true me or something. Mm-hmm. It's just energy. And the other nice thing about saying energy is it's not nothing. It's not like emptiness is like
it's
just void. Yeah.
It's that which is in everything, rock, dog, person, wood, you know, and that to a certain extent.
Well, that's a somewhat questionable. Again, according to tradition, we wouldn't say that rock, Buddha nature is in rock.
Well,
now, there is in Zen, there are these kind of teachings.
So it comes back to the point about the concept of bodhisattva and the mirage. I mean, the sort of the behavioral safety net of the bodhisattva is to enjoy the mirage by virtue of knowing that
Mm. Yeah, something like that. And I think we just any descriptions of Buddha nature, we just have to be careful not to fall into our limited ways of thinking about it. Well, we have to create limited ways, like the story of the pool of water with the sediment. They're just metaphors to help us approach it. But to take any one of them and say like, that's it. Now I got it. It's just energy. But energy, I think, is a good, as far as words that can point towards it, I think it's pretty good, yeah. Yes.
In Hinduism, what I've read, I've always read the Brahma. Brahma is the transcendent energy.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think we can, you know, these different religions will argue with each other about what's what, but I think my understanding of Hinduism, yeah, very, very much. In fact, I would even venture to say that these Tathagatagarbha teachings that came later in Buddhism were probably influenced by Hindu Brahman and even Atman. And this is what this section is going to talk about now. It's a little kind of Hindu-Buddhist dialogue about, are you saying that this is the Atman that the Hindus talk about? Because the Atman is not like the ego self, my understanding in the Vedic tradition, Hinduism, is that Atman's like this kind of like true core nature.
Soul.
soul, like a soul, and they even get into things like it resides in the heart, and it's what's reborn in the Hindu thing. The Atman doesn't come and go; it's ever unchanging nature, and it has a kind of identity, not a kind of personality identity, but it's like it's like a thing. It's like almost like entity. It's like a singular, unchanging entity. And the Buddha's Anatman, which was one of the Buddha's early radical teachings, saying, I don't see why we have to say there's some entity there, because we can't find that thing. Mm-hmm. Even the Hindus say that you can't like say, oh, here it is. So like, it sounds like a metaphysical concept. And Buddha was really into like going to direct experience, cutting through weird metaphysical ideas. So he's saying, just look for who you think you are, and you'll find these conditioned things called the five skandhas. And do you see anything else? And the Hindus might say, yeah, when we see the five skandhas are not me, but what's really me is the Atman. And the Buddha said, well, where did you come up with that? Why do you need to do that? Why not just say, no five skandhas? But one reason why you might say Atman is because if we're not these five skandhas, if we're not our body and mind, then extreme terror might arise at like, well then, what? Just give me something to hold on to. Even if it's inconceivable, I can at least hold on to an Atman. But this is the section here where we're going to say, isn't this Tathagata Garbha sounds a lot like an Atman to me. Let's keep going a little bit, okay? Through this section. The Tathagata Garbha is intrinsically pure, endowed with the 32 attributes, and present in the bodies of all beings. Literally, this would be sentient beings. And that, like a priceless jewel wrapped in soiled clothing of the obscurations, the ever-present, unchanging Tathagata Garbha is likewise wrapped in the soiled clothing of the skandhas, dhatus, and ayatanas, which are these Abhidharma terms, without going into all the details. They're basically, the dhatus and the ayatanas are other versions of the five skandhas. They're conditioned consciousness and karmically conditioned dharmas that make us up, right? Or you could also say alaya vijnana, I think, for skandhas, the soil clothing of the alaya. But here he's saying the soil clothing of the body and mind that we think we are, the sentient being we think we are, and stained with the stain of the erroneous projections of greed, anger, and delusion. And that's what all Buddhas teach. So this is a really nice sentence for the classic description of Tathagata Garbha. It's intrinsically pure, ever-present, and it's wrapped, it's in this, like a priceless jewel, in the who we think we are, basically. And then Mahamati says, how is it that when the Bhagavan says about the Tathagata Garbha, how is it that what the Bhagavan says about the Tathagata Garbha is the same as what followers of other paths say about a self, an Atman? Because the Atman is also an unchanging, ever-present essence of oneself wrapped in the skandhas. Actually, right? So how is it that this is different than that? Because I know you teach Anatman, Bhagavan. Bhagavan, followers of other paths also speak of an immortal creator without attributes, omnipresent and indestructible. And they say this, Bhagavan is the self. So the Buddha replied, Mahamati, the Tathagata Garbha of which I speak is not the same as the self mentioned by followers of other paths. Mahamati, when I speak about the Tathagata Garbha, sometimes I call it, now this is different from the self, sometimes I call this Buddha nature, I call it emptiness. We don't call the self emptiness. Emptiness, shunyata, or formlessness, animita. Again, nimitta is what Red Pine calls appearances. So we could say formlessness or appearancelessness. Animita, or intentionlessness. These are actually these four samadhis that are sometimes listed, the empty, signless, wishless samadhis, or realm of reality, I sometimes call it, or dharma nature. Dharmata is like the nature of all dharmas. Or dharma body, dharmakaya, I call it that. So even though we're saying the fruition, the unobscured Buddha nature is the dharmakaya, but sometimes I call it dharmakaya, or nirvana, cessation of everything that we think. What is devoid of self-existence? Nisvabhavata is absence of own being. It's another word for emptiness. You know, the svabhava is like own being or inherent existence. So nisvabhava. Actually, there's an extra VA in there that's a misprint. It's actually nisvabhavata. And that's could be like the absence of inherent existence. Or what neither arises nor ceases, or original quiescence, or intrinsic nirvana, or similar expressions. So they're all these kind of negating things, right? So they're that make sure that it's not some fixed, truly existent self. We can call it emptiness or lack of inherent existence. And yet it's unchanging, beginningless and endless, and it's the true nature of who we are. So these two sides, or another way of talking about the two sides is it's empty, completely free of all characteristics, and it's luminously aware and bright, always like, again, it's like it has the nature of suchness, but it's also aware. But it's aware in a completely non-dual way, but it's alive, it's not nothing. And this is, you know, traditionally like a rock actually has suchness too. A rock is empty of all fixed characteristics, but a rock traditionally doesn't have Buddha nature because it's not aware. Mm-hmm. Now again, like Chinese tradition and Zen started getting into like the inanimate world having Buddha nature. Yeah, rocks, pebbles, and walls. It's kind of like, you know, in the Indian tradition, that wouldn't hold up. But because Zen people are, their names don't have to be fused to characteristics in this fixed way. They can say like, well, I know the sutras don't say that rocks have Buddha nature, but we're free to say that. No one can stop us. So, but then we can ask, is it helpful? And what does that mean? Is it trying to break down the last distinctions between sentient beings and non-sentient beings? Because that's a distinction, right? Sentient beings have Buddha nature, but non-sentient beings don't. But then, you know, Dongshan gets into this whole conversation about inanimate beings preaching the Dharma. Maybe rocks can teach Dharma because they have Buddha nature. Maybe they're actually Nirmanakaya Buddhas. If people can wake up from their relationship with a rock, maybe has happened. There's one Zen ancestor that did wake up with his relationship with a rock. Do you know that story? He was sweeping and a little rock hit a bamboo. Little Nirmanakaya rock hit a bamboo, and he had a great awakening. Did that pebble have Buddha nature? So, I see we're about out of time. Let me just finish this last little paragraph that follows up with this. It's to put an end to the fear that foolish beings have about the expression no self, nairatmiya or anatman, that the Tathagatas, the Arhats, the fully enlightened ones proclaim the teaching of the Tathagata Garbha as a projectionless realm, nirvikalpa realm, devoid of fabrications. Mahamati, bodhisattvas of the present and the future should not become attached to any view of a self. So that's like one heart of the Buddha heart. teachings in the sutra.
Not attached to any view of the self, does not bar having a view of the self. It just does not be attached to it.
Should not become attached to any view of a self. Yeah, there's some interesting things too about Buddha nature in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. That one of the key teachings in there is that a lot of it is about Buddha nature. And these four characteristics of Buddha nature are the reversal of these early characteristics of conditioned things. So conditioned things are impermanent. They have no self. They're infused with dissatisfaction, and impure. Impure meaning like they're just defiled by our dualistic consciousness. So Buddha nature is permanent. It's pure. It's permanent, pure. It's blissful instead of suffering. And the most radical one is that it's self. They actually call it Atman. In this particular Mahayana important sutra, the Buddha nature is like true self. It's a true Atman. Sometimes they call it Atma Paramita, which means like the self that's gone beyond self. Or the transcendent self, or we say perfection of wisdom, like the perfection of self.
Big S.
But that's like I think the most controversial these things get is that actually this such an important teaching of the Buddha, no self, but then this Buddha nature is actually like true self. But it's not a conditioned phenomena. All conditioned phenomena have no self.
It lacks special characteristics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not a thing. Yeah.
Your teaching tonight reminded me over and over again of the Lojong slogan, liberate even the antidote.
So the antidote being no self, liberate that by like not getting stuck in this idea of no self.
Just whenever I'm getting a fixed idea of what something means.
Yeah.
It comes to carpet
pool. Yeah, liberate even the antidote. They don't fixate on these things, nor do they not fixate on these things. Yeah. So as we get into these Buddha nature teachings, we have one more class. There's a lot here. You can read ahead, and as a practice thing. With I think these Buddha nature teachings, the greatest practice thing is just to contemplate these stories and stuff, and just open to this possibility. It's not something that we can like get a hold of, right? But just through hearing about it, this possibility that our true nature is like a Buddha's non-dual perfect wisdom infused with Buddha characteristics of like great compassion is part of it, actually. Total love with no barriers at all is like in here, but it's blocked, right? It's obscured. But to open to the possibility more and more that's who we actually are, is a great fuel for practice, I think. And for depression and for discouragement, like our practice isn't going so well. How are we ever going to be a Buddha? It's medicine for those thoughts. And those obscured thoughts that block it, right? May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.